Hello and welcome to episode 2 of Idea of Evil, a podcast all about Berserk. I am Reed McCarter. I'm here representing Bullet Points. I am joined by Gareth Damian Martin, representing Heterotopias. Gareth.
Hello.
But why we're really here is to return to Berserk, the most evil comic book, the comic book they don't want you to read, the comic book that you have to hide under your mattress when your parents are coming by your bedroom because you're 8 and you shouldn't be reading Berserk. We are now on to, we left off the last episode with The Brand, which was the first 2 chapters of Berserk, and now we are moving on to Guardians of Desire is what we're covering. So the next, I guess it's about 2 volumes. It's the last chapter of volume 1, if I'm right, and then all of volume 2, and then 2 out of 3 chapters in volume 3, I think.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, Gareth.
No, I'm just saying you're right. Although it's the Guardian Angels of Desire. Is it?
I don't know.
No, don't Guardians of Desire. I'm totally wrong. Sorry. Ignore me. Totally useless.
I'll say again at this point, just at the beginning, as we're trying to set the pace and everything for this, we've discussed different things about how much to cover, in a given episode, and it won't be necessarily at this pace. Always, we're going to always say what we're covering next time if you want to read along before the next episode comes out. But sort of the decisions about where we're what we're covering at a given time is based on kind of story beats rather than trying to be completely arbitrary about saying, you know, a volume ends and if something's, you know, a story arc is in the middle of happening, we're just going to cut. We'd rather kind of try to arrange it more neatly. So hopefully that works and it sets a good pace. But Gareth, why don't we get right into this?
Yeah.
What did you think of this section?
Yeah. So Guardians of Desire is kind of, I think we talked about this a little bit last time, but it's kind of interesting how it picks up from The Brand and the Black Swordsman, which introduced the kind of wandering swordsman version of Guts, where he's traveling, being hunted by ghosts, and kind of being generally grumpy and hunting demons. And it kind of almost stages a redo of the first 2 chapters, in the sense that it's once again about somebody in power, this time a count, who is here executing heretics for an undisclosed reason at the start. It has a sweaty, big-eyed old man as his foil, who even at the beginning of this section is kind of sweating and being like, yes, my lord, no, we shouldn't kill too many heretics, which is that character we've already kind of seen in The Brand, in The Black Swordsman. And so we straight away have this setup of Guts pitched against a somebody in power who is obviously has some kind of demonic stuff going on in the background, some demonic action, and Guts kind of rolls into town and is here to fight or expel this demon.
Yeah, and it's this, I said to you before we started recording that this rereading this section of the story again, I had almost no recollection of, not that I had almost no recollection, I had merged what we had covered before with this stuff in my mind into kind of one thing, because I think there are merits to what's going on in this thing, but I think the way you put it, that this essentially is like starting it again, is kind of true. It's sort of the same exact setup happening with, you know, wandering swordsman Guts and his little elf friend Puck coming into a town. You know, here's this evil, ruler of this area, and there's going to be a demon fight, and he's going to fight some soldiers too, and that's about it. But this section does manage to, it ends, I think, in a way that's, it kind of hits a lot of the same beats, but then it opens up towards something that by the time we're done with this section, we are fully entering prime Berserk land.
I think, but I think you're right about the kind of the almost repeated element, and I'm not surprised you kind of rolled them into two be into one thing, because you even get the like it was much too big to be called a sword bit of narration that we have in the first section when Guts turns up with his sword again right at the beginning, and we have like a load of guards getting chopped into pieces again, and all of this like the kind of restaging or like the reinforcement of this same set of things. But one of the things I think early on that really struck me in this section with the count is this kind of this like classical influences that are coming in. They seem to come in a lot stronger in this section in a way that they're kind of hanging around, and we spoke about them a little bit, but I think we kind of spoke about them in advance of them appearing. And one of the first ones is when we get the story from, I don't even know if this character has a name, but it is the kind of one-eyed guy who like previously is a character who appears like he's going to have a role in the story, but he's actually just here to do some exposition about the count and then immediately get killed.
Do you mean the man, the myth? Vargas,
Vargas, you're
Vargas.
right, he does have a name.
Listen, I have berserk.fandom.com open in front of me, so I don't flip as much.
All the Berserk heads will be very disappointed by me not remembering the name of Vargas. But
Yeah.
yeah,
There are only so many little creeps you can keep in your brain at one time.
yeah, what's that?
Sniveling lords and little creeps.
That thing that's like the people say that a video game is just a little guy running around. I think like Berserk is just a load of creeps, right? And one guy with a big sword. That's what's bizarre. So he's one of these little creeps. Although the twist with this creep is he's not actually a creep. Even though he's horribly mutilated, it turns out that he's not actually evil
Yeah,
or
okay.
suspicious.
Thanks. I'm sorry I called him a little creep.
Yeah, that's okay. But in part of his flashback of his torture at the hands of the Count, there's this one panel of the Count like eating a person, and all you can see is like their legs and their butt sticking out of the Count's mouth, and it is a absolutely like it's when I saw it when I was rereading this, I was immediately to the
Martin
internet
Goya.
to look at Hieronymus Bosch and Goya paintings, because I was like, I know this is something that I know. And it's kind of like a combination of one of the devils from the Garden of Earthly Delights from by Hieronymus Bosch, the medieval, whose work, even if you've never heard that name before, you will know is kind of playful, weird medieval paintings of hell and heaven, with a series of grotesque creatures, and who is referenced explicitly in later Berserk. And also the another kind of famous image, which is Goya's Saturn devouring his son, which is again an image you'll probably know, even if you don't know, you know it, of a what looks like a long-haired giant eating a child, and the child is missing their head and their arm is kind of hanging out of their mouth, and they're being held up in a way that you can see their back and their legs.
And I think sort of importantly is, very is sort of drenched in black, like inky black shadow, and sort of obscures the exact, no, it's not fair to say obscures the detail, but sort of, gives it sort of like a very nightmarish kind of quality, like shining a flashlight on something in the
Yeah,
dark.
absolutely. Yeah, and I think I mean, that's part of kind of Goya's painting style as well, where it also the anatomy is kind of slightly distorted or unclear, kind of misty or It's not a kind of Caravaggio with extremely precise studies of the human body. It's very dreamlike and kind of unsettling. And I just it really struck me going back through this that like that's just one of five panels on a page in the corner, but it's so present. And I think that the count generally just feels so built out of kind of classical imagery to me. We have like he also kind of evokes Gargantua and Pantagruel, the Rabelais books, which were illustrated by Gustave Doré, who I've mentioned already, but I'll probably be mentioning over and over again because of his influence on Berserk, but I'll try not to mention too many times. But the Count is this kind of big, overstuffed man whose kind of perversity is this kind of grotesque greed for eating people. And he's kind of weirdly has this weirdly flattened kind of wide head and these massive oversized eyes. And he just yeah he just feels like he's really playing into this kind of history of the grotesque and the carnivalesque, but in a way that's not it's not just kind of I guess like, oh, hey, look at this scary guy. But there's a kind of, as with a lot of Berserk, there's a kind of delight in depicting this person. Like there's a choice here that, you know, when you decide to design your character like this and you know you're going to draw them for kind of 50, 60 panels or whatever, or 50, 60 pages, that there's an interest here in like exploring like how this character takes up space on the page and his kind of like and how he represents evil in the context of this story as a person in power who is using that power more so than necessarily a demon. We get him later as a kind of demon, but there's something about the kind of idea of corruption and cartoonish kind of depictions of corruption in power that seems to come through with this character really strongly. And that's just a long way of saying basically that I just really like this character design of this guy.
He looks great. He looks great when he transforms as well, when he turns into this sort of a giant slug type thing with two mouths, because he's, you know, like you're saying, he's so intent on devouring everything, which I think is the way he's fought as well, which, you know, is going to happen in a lot of different contexts, but sort of involves the wholesale destruction of everything around him. Just kind of, you know, and that's, I think, genre, but that's also works well with Mira, with these, you know, giant swords and these giant demon monsters and, you know, entire sections of castles just sort of crumbling as these like kind of demigod-like figures are clashing there. I wanted to say though, because one thing that was kind of brought up to me, and I think this is something that stuck out to me from this section that we covered, is how this starts to get into what evil is in Berserk, in a way that's, I think, defined more clearly and with in a way that's going to carry through a lot of the series. You start to get a look here at what Mira is going to portray as evil, and I think it's not something we're going to untangle entirely in this episode, because it's, you know, that's sort of what this entire comic is obsessed with, is the nature of evil. But it's something here that, like, I thought it was interesting when you have this figure, when you have the Count, and he's supposed to be, I think, sort of difficult to look at in the sense of, you know, he is grotesque, and you also have, and, you know, look how terrible I am that I called him a little creep, but you do have a deformed character who does initially appear like a little demon or something, the character Vargas, who then is portrayed for at least, until he's executed in this, is portrayed as like, I think heroic figure would be too strong, but he's definitely portrayed as a good figure. And he's also sort of he's freaky looking as well. And I think pretty early on here, you see that Mira is not entirely going to show you that characters who look unsettling or ugly are necessarily ideologically or spiritually ugly, you know?
Yeah, totally. And I think there's a such an obvious connection being made between Vargas and Guts himself, with the kind of missing eye motif that is then also used as a way of connecting Vargas to the one-eyed fetus-like creature that haunts Guts. And so there's a through line there. In terms of, like you say, deformity or disability or damaged bodies not necessarily being that kind of classic horror cliche of reflecting a deformed or somehow wrong interior, but actually existing as kind of evidence of external evil or external violence or cruelty in the world, right? Is it especially Vargas? He's there to be an image of the cruelty of the Count. And while the Count is kind of also disturbing, he's not really kind of as hard to look at as Vargas. And he's actually there's a kind of an aesthetic of smoothness to the Count. Later on, we also see him in his kind of heroic days before he became corrupted. And there he's kind of a tall, bald-headed, like soldier in armor. And it really connects to this idea of his kind of obsession with purity, which is kind of becomes his motivating factor. Because he's trying to root out these heretics that we see later on a cult that and kind of I trying to find the word I was going to say entrapped, but it's not explicit whether or not they entrapped his wife, but it's definitely explicit that there was an orgy between the cult and his wife, and some kind of demon worship. In a another one of those heavy metal painted on the side of the van scenes, but that there's this kind of sense of smoothness and purity to the Count that really interests me when counterpointed with Vargas, who is just completely torn apart, really. He's basically he's portrayed as a kind of walking corpse, really, and that's why, yeah, we're initially kind of given this sense of, oh, this guy must be some evil being. But yeah, as you say, he's defined to be very sympathetic, and is actually the kind of key becomes a key motivator for Guts when he's executed, in terms of Guts kind of trying to find where he fits in this narrative or how emotionally, because as usual he kind of says, he tells Vargas that he's a like you would read, he tells him that he's a little creep. Or something similar. A good for nothing bastard.
Guts and I are a lot alike in
Oh,
that
he
way.
actually, yeah, he calls him a maggoty creep.
Well, it's a lot worse than I said,
So,
so I feel better
yeah,
now.
you didn't say maggoty.
He probably calls him a weakling probably at some point
Yeah,
too.
that's quite a classic.
I think he I wonder if it's worth just zooming really quickly. Because I feel like we're discussing things that are like halfway through, and I wonder if it's worth giving the sort of overview of where this ends up. Which I guess is that so Guts meets Vargas, who has the behelit, which we know is called a behelit. Is that how you would pronounce it?
I've never said it out loud before, and earlier before we started recording, you said that, and I thought to myself, that sounds good.
Oh, God.
So I no, so I'm gonna say yes.
Well, I don't know how to pronounce it's a bit behelit, I guess. Guts sees that Vargas has this in his little his Frankenstein's laboratory that he's got going. That he has this object that's a red egg that has a nose and closed eyes and a mouth that are sort of scattered over the surface of the egg. They're not arranged in a face. They're nonsensical. They're like a cubist Picasso would make more sense than this weird little red egg. And he takes notice of this, and he knows what it is, and he asks Vargas to tell him. Vargas gives the background that his wife and children were tortured and executed, as was he, by this count. And then Vargas, in turn, is executed as part of the count executing heretics, which spurs Guts to action. And I guess the sort of what happens in the latter half of this is we're introduced to the count's daughter, who he keeps locked in a room. Her name is Teresia or Teresia. I don't know how you would pronounce that either.
Yeah, Teresa, I think.
Yeah, he keeps her locked up in her bedroom, gives her Puck as a gift, and that kind of, she and Puck have these conversations about how the Duke, or the Count rather, used to be this heroic figure. I feel like this is too much to
No, you're
summarize
there.
this
You're
quickly.
there. And then, yeah, and
Okay.
then Guts
And then
basically
the
rocks up and fights the count from that point on.
Yeah, he fights him. He notably he his fingers are all broken, so he picks up his sword with his teeth and chops he chops the count's neck, his disgusting slug neck, in half. And then they go to hell.
Yeah, they do.
Which is kind of the second half of this part that we cover here is their journey to hell, which introduces the God Hand. Or God Hand, which is Guts recognizes one of them, who is a mysterious figure who is wearing sort of a bird-like armor that's sort of attached to him in this kind of like H.R. Giger looking wet, glistening, like metal vinyl clothes that these demons wear. They sort of look like the Cenobites or something from Hellraisers,
They look like a band
but
for
you
sure. The first time they're introduced,
they
they're a band.
well they're striking a sweet pose. They're perfectly spaced out. They have a good like height differential, and yeah, they look like a great album cover. But the Count, when he's dying, and he uses the behelit, which falls into a pool of his blood, to say like, God Hand, come and help me. So we find out that this egg that Vargas had, which I guess the Count found on it. No, we know why he found it. Trying to be quick, they end up in hell. God Hand is there. Guts recognizes one of them called Griffith, who is wearing this eagle armor. The God Hand are these demonic figures who tell the Count that he can be restored to life if he once again sacrifices something to them. And they say, if you sacrifice your daughter, give her soul to us, then or let her be branded with the same brand that Guts has on his neck, then he can be restored to life. We find out that the Count has made a deal with them before. His wife actually was involved, maybe was a leader in or something, or like a priestess in. It's kind of hinted maybe that she was of the pagan cult that was operating here. And she was, yeah, having orgies with these sort of, what are they called? What's that guy called? The like classic demon with the goat head.
Bethlehem?
Yeah. My summary's going on too long already.
No, that's, yeah, that makes sense. And then,
And
yeah,
yeah, you
then
close
he chooses not to,
it out.
right? He chooses not to sacrifice himself, sacrifice his daughter.
He's racked with pain about it, and that's why they show his daughter what happened, that he was the one who actually tortured her mother, his wife, to death for being a pagan. Or he sacrificed her, rather, to the God Hand.
Yeah, and then he's claimed by a huge fleshy pile of corpses that comes out of hell. I should say, and we'll get maybe we'll come back to this, but like this other dimension is Escher's stairs, and hell is this kind of vast whirlwind of
Yes.
corpses, and out of this vast whirlwind of corpses come the corpses, and they claim the Count to take him to hell, and Vargas is one of the corpses that takes him to hell.
Yeah.
And we come back to reality, or the destroyed castle, also to an image of the Count. It's kind of just a partial some partial parts of the Count's torso, which feels like, again, evoking those kind of references from before, but reversed, with the Count as the victim. And shall we, before we get into this last bit, because I feel like there's things to talk about in this last bit that
It's this whole other thing, so maybe we
is like
should.
a whole it is like a whole other thing with its own problems. So let's talk about the God Hand
You want to talk?
and
Yeah,
hell.
you want to talk about hell?
I do want to talk about hell. Like I said, yeah, it's Escher's incredible, impossible stairs, which, otherwise known as David Bowie's Labyrinth, obviously. Is that too deep of a cut
No,
into the
no,
movie Labyrinth?
no. I have not seen Labyrinth in a long time, but I knew that there was that Escher. Isn't there the thing where he's like, or isn't he like dancing or
Yeah.
something and singing, and he's going up and down them, and it's
He's chasing the baby
like Escher stares kind of.
around M.C. Escher's stairs, which actually, God, I'm not going to look up the dates, but it feels like pretty close. I guess like there must have been a period when Escher was just really back in, like these stairs were just really the thing.
I feel like Escher has never gone anywhere, really. I feel like you could always find, or but maybe that says something about, my generation
No,
of,
you probably could
like, I
always
feel like
find Escher's stairs, like in someone's
this,
dorm room or whatever, right? Like in a poster.
yeah, the stairs and the reflecting globe,
Yeah,
right?
and the birds becoming fishes pattern.
Oh yes,
But
yeah.
yeah, they're deployed here in their classic usage, which seems to be the most consistent usage, because it's exactly the same as David Bowie's Labyrinth usage, which is they're deployed to represent the other dimension, or the meeting point of dimensions, maybe more accurately. This kind of, which I, yeah, like this kind of conceit that these multi-gravitational levels where people can be stood on the roof and all of the stairs lead in different directions suggests that, well, we're in between worlds, right? We're in some kind of mid-space. And so while I do love a reference, I have to admit that I think in comparison to a lot of other visual things in Berserk, I do think that Escher stairs are kind of just phoning it in a bit. It does feel
Yeah.
like I don't know, maybe it hit different in 1989 or 1991, whichever this was. But it feels a bit loose. But then we have this like also whirling corpse cloud, which I think still rocks, really. Who doesn't love
Yeah, and
a
it's.
Rodin-esque version of hell? Or it reminds me of that boss from Castlevania. Symphony of the Night. There's like a in the basement, there's like a big thing that's made of people. It's like a big ball made of people, and it's very similar to this.
I didn't get that far in Symphony of the Night.
No, it has a name,
I was too young.
but it's also, it's also Dark
I didn't have a
Souls.
memory card,
No.
so so there's only so far I could get when I rented
Never.
Symphony of the
You do
Night.
know that the castle turns upside down, right? Okay,
Yeah.
good.
I mean, I do live in the
That's
world.
good.
I leave my house and I talk to my neighbors and they say, you know the castle.
Yeah,
And you get past 100% completion. People say that in stores and what I was going to say about yes, the corpse trail is great. I feel kind of two ways. I think just on an immediate like visual impact, the Escher stairs don't do much for me. Which is kind of sad, I guess, in a sense, because it's the first time you see God, the God Hand show up, and they're striking their poses, and I forget the I don't know if we're actually even supposed to know all their names yet, but the big Mars Attacks looking guy with the eyes sewn shut is standing upside down the entire time, kind of like a bat, as is the woman with the snake hair. And so there's a interesting use of the stairs as, these extra dimensional demonic beings are kind of inhabiting these different planes. Like they're, the gravity is allowing them to stand upside down or sort of sideways and in proportion to in comparison to the main characters, but it's not visually striking. It doesn't feel evil enough. I mean, they certainly, the God Hand themselves look certainly like very weird and frightening, but as a first depiction, like I don't think it even holds up to when you have Guts walking through the woods in the last chapters and the ghosts and so forth are coming and moaning and taunting about the brand. I don't think this is It's a little too cold, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
It's the lines are a bit neat. And I can kind of see, like, I do, in one sense, a depiction of hell that's sort of disordered, or it's hell, but it isn't hell. It's a maybe another dimension, and this is stuff that will come up more and more. But a vision of hell that's sort of disordered order that kind of takes something as rational and sensible as a staircase and plays with it in that Escher way of distorting the directions of the stairs and sort of the logic of the stairs is, that's a like the structure of Inferno or something where you have Dis in hell as I think actually maybe it's Dore who draws it as like a classical amphitheater that contains demons and tormented souls
Yeah.
where you sort of have these structures that are like very normal and kind of great symbols of human logic and order, and then you twist them so that you're showing hell as this place where that's not counted upon is interesting. I don't think it works super well in this part here. If that,
No, I agree.
yeah, it just leaves me a bit cold, is like, I think maybe the best way to put it.
Yeah, and I think the imagery that we kind of the instead it's the leading up imagery that's stronger, I think, that the kind of count as he slowly becomes this kind of nudibranch sea worm like creature with a kind of head on top of a mouth that could, and then there's this incredible bit in the fight where his daughter turns up and he's kind of looking for her, and he's kind of doing the like monster with a human voice. He's kind of calling out for it,
Yeah.
which is just horrific and incredibly powerful, I think. This like, and I think the Count in general, is a kind of ho wonderfully horrifying figure of He's still kind of he gets committed to Hel because he still kind of wants to protect his daughter somehow, despite the fact that he has created this situation. But also that kind of that balance of him being incredibly monstrous, but also kind of completely emotionally distraught and kind of lost and confused and stretched out and distorted into something. And it's really there's also a fantastic flip in that fight where like Guts looks like he's kind of going to be completely destroyed by this monster, but in the end we get Guts' kind of entire combat tactic, which is just to take it basically. And then, like you say, chop off his head by holding this giant sword between his teeth in the most outrageous fashion. And then we have him kind of laughing as he guts this, literally, as he guts this worm. And it's yeah, like we get like Guts at his most kind of terrifying in relation to this kind of sad and twisted creature. And I think the flips that happen there are so much more powerful and interesting than then this kind of distant, people stood around on staircases like casting judgment, which I kind of understand, but yeah, lacks that kind of the viscerality and the kind of what we talked about in the last episode as being the kind of intimacy of Berserk sometimes, and it's the way in which it's kind of closeness to violence. Yes, it kind of luxuriates in it, as you've said before, but it also kind of, yeah, it stays in there and it just keeps going. Like it keeps pushing at something to get to points where it's like, oh, where is too far here? Where is like the end point? And it's the Baelit which gets us into this stairs world. And I still think the Baelit is one of the coolest and most interesting visual images in Berserk,
Oh yeah,
this
it's
eye with the randomly assorted face that then realigns when it sits in the blood and becomes a face, and then that's a face screaming. It just feels so.
it's so good. And it's an egg as well. And it's screaming. Like it's like sort of like bathing in spilled life, and then it's like horrified at what it does. It's referred to as a key, so it's like it's open, it's sort of bridging these dimensions between the human and the demonic worlds. And when it's covered in blood, it awakens, and its response to doing what it's made to do is to become ordered and then scream. Like it's just so, it's upsetting in a fascinating way. Like I think that's one of the it's something that is used as iconography from the series a lot, I think for a good reason, because it sticks in your head.
Yeah, totally. And it feels like it also has that kind of classical, like it's almost like a distorted version of a bust, right? Of like a kind of classical marble bust. It has that kind of quality of being a beautiful treasure of the past somehow, or but then the way in which it relates to all of these other distorted bodies and this idea of physical, these connections that, obviously at times, and I think, it's not like Muir is or always on the right side of this, but I think that it the Baelit feels like it fits on that on a side of that that works really well, where yeah, this idea of order and distortion and violence, yeah, the kind of becoming human in the moment that it, like it begins supernatural, right? Like it, I've always find it fascinating that it's an object that the facial features are misaligned, and then in the moment that it becomes the kind of ethereal key to another dimension, it aligns into a human face as opposed to the other way around. Feels so such an important decision, and it feels like it captures a lot of those things that are really hard to describe about Berserk, that point to why Berserk is not just a kind of pulp, not just a pulp narrative, really. To me, that it kind of gets at something that's really hard to put your finger on, but it feels very powerful, in the narrative and in the experience of reading it.
And I think what you're saying there too, I do think despite not being bowled over by how the God Hand stuff looks, I was going to say before as well that it does to me, I think it's the right move in the narrative at this point to not just expand the scope of where the story is going, so it's not just the weekly adventures of Guts and his monster killing. It's also going to get into this larger fictional world, and then as we'll see, it's going to go into his backstory as well. But I think like the way that the Behelit shows up in this and shows like that kind of literally like unstated kind of elegance of the way it opens this passage between dimensions or transports them. I think you see there is something kind of, I don't want to say nuance because it's not super nuanced, but there is an invitation in this one to start maybe taking what's being portrayed in this a little bit more seriously, in terms of how it handles what is, an episode of like a pulp horror story. I think the Count's story and then kind of the way a lot of things are communicated about what evil is now that it's more fully contrasted against these literal demonic, overlords. It makes clear very much in this section that the demons are important and they love terrible things, and helping to inflict suffering, but the suffering is very much human. It's they are just kind of observing it and enjoying it. This one, I think the whole story of the Count is Berserk starting to toy with how terrible humans can make our own situations by, I think in this one right here, it's saying essentially that reactive violence and a desire to control everything around you is destructive. But I think that's maybe a little bit of what it communicates. But yeah, I do think we start to see here that, this series is more interested in the texture of evil than it is in just showing you shocking stuff.
No, totally. And because it's interested in the Count being a tragic figure, I think. Which, obviously is nothing special in terms of having your villain in the episode be also a tragic figure with motivations. But I do think in the context where that character becomes a vast demonic slug that looks like the last boss of a Resident Evil game and probably is the model for multiple bosses in Resident Evil games, is then kind of, is then as a half severed slug head on the floor, like watching this stuff play out, is it does feel like he, yeah, like you say, there's a kind of monster human relationship here that Muir is getting into that is not really about monsters, and more about his own want to represent human suffering or evil through certain visual motifs. He's not interested in building a kind of coherent like demonology or like a concept of like monsters as like like a kind of typical maybe Monster Hunter style narrative or Vampire Hunter style narrative where there might be a kind of bestiary of different creatures. It's not about that. The demons that infest humans in this story are manifestations of their kind of human failings or of their distortion or corruption and That's the world we're in. You know, there is no explanation for why this creature is a vast slug-like creature. It's not, you know, we're not getting into some kind of, we're stretching out to a wider world with the God Hand, but we're not stretching out to a wider world that is going to give us some kind of explanation of what all of these phenomena we're looking at are. We're still very close to the blade of the violence and the suffering, I think.
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, I think the way you just put that is like one of the better explanations for me of why this works and why the stuff that is that would otherwise just look kind of corny or fun, like sort of hell as doom aesthetic, kind of like, you know, this rules, this is a metal album cover or a side of a van or something. Is actually lingers in this way is I think it is it's maybe closer to like an Abrahamic religion view of like Satan not as is sort of a pre like kind of like a pre Dante version of Satan as a force, as an amorphous force that is sort of coloring aspects of our lives, not as, you know, a literal jumping up and down horned man who lives in, you know, a hell that's constructed of different layers where or different circles where people go depending on their exact sins. It's something that's more like kind of elemental and makes it frightening in the sense of it's a reflection of how these characters move through the world and what they do. It's not Satan luring them towards something, it's them inviting evil into their lives, based on, you know, their excesses, their pride, their weakness, like which is maybe, I don't know, from my viewpoint as, you know, with my own outlook on the world is to me kind of a more interesting way of looking at how evil functions.
Yeah, and it does connect again to those, you know, not just in an aesthetic way, but to those texts I kind of mentioned earlier, like the text that Doré illustrated, or like, you know, like the Divine Comedy, or like Gargantua Pantagruel, which is a kind of satirical story about two giants in France, and it's a kind of satire on France, really, a kind of epic satire on French culture from the 16th century by Rabelais. And it's, you know, in those stories, these kind of monstrous manifestations that are, yeah, related to power and satire are always kind of relational to the acts of the character, or in the same way, it's that same idea of like the punishments in hell being matched to your the crimes you portray, you know, you perpetrated on earth, right? This is a very particular, as you say, formation of religion that it in Berserk, it feels like it's connecting to that those concepts, but it's not really interested in the religious aspect of it in the end. It's interested in the human aspect of it, which is ultimately what Dante was interested in, even if it was in the 16th century. You know, it was a he wrote himself into that, you know, that was about an individual existing in a subjective space of hell and heaven, and how could they find their way amongst all of these demons and angels, you know. Yeah, and like we have, so ultimately, like in that God Hand sequence, I think in to bring it back to Berserk, is like the most compelling image is still guts, right? It's when we get some really, again, some really strong images of guts kind of crawling around on the floor, and kind of being, you know, blood kind of pouring out of him, and with his weird broken fingers, and bleeding from his teeth that he used to pick up the sword, and like he is counterpointed as explicitly human in relation to these kind of rock
Yeah.
star devils, basically, who look like they're really like an overblown Spinal Tap staging.
Oh, sorry.
No, and yeah, like Guts is, it's like, no, how much more blood can you get, or how many more bones can you break, right? Like it becomes absurd.
There are always
There
more.
always for Guts, there are always more, but it's pushing towards definitely this relation between the profane and the human and the idea of a sentient. In fact, I think the one of the last things, they say to the squid, the half decapitated squid head, is they're saying that, they gave him the gift of being a demon so he could transcend his very humanity, right? So that's what's at stake
Yeah.
here, is not actually, despite the grandeur of this, it's not the existence of the world or hell, or it's actually just the humanity of one man, which is being judged and played out in this kind of grand
And
amphitheater.
is reinforced too in him struggling, the count struggling with what's about to happen to him. You know, just before that happened, and I think in one of the probably the most like violent moments in, you know, and I'm saying this in contrast to Guts with his gigantic sword like cutting through five dudes like at once, is when he's defeated the count and the count's sort of lying there as a slug head, Guts is just stabbing him over and over, and Puck and his daughter sort of turn away disgusted. By how much he's sort of relishing this kind of unnecessary violence, this opportunity to just stab him in the head over and over, because the Count had been gloating about how he can't die. And so Guts is taking pleasure in having defeated him and prolonging his misery. But so the entire time that they're in this hellish dimension, the Count is there as this, yeah, like you said, this sort of half like a squid that was running off the chopping block and just got away, and then is lying there. But the entire time he's crying about he doesn't want to die. You know, that's the whole thing here,
Yeah.
is he's weighing not wanting to inflict further harm on his daughter, who he's starting to realize now he has harmed horribly by all of his decisions. Which were sort of aimed toward protecting her from, you know, her mother's Baphomet orgies, you know. But the main thing is he doesn't want to die. He's terrified of losing this existence he had as something more than human, which Miura captures very well. There's a lot of eye close-ups, and the count as this half chopped squid is just sort of, for like the second half of everything we're talking about here, is just lying there sort of looking with these kind of weepy eyes or eye all the time, like very pitiful, and looks like it's terrified of everything that's going on. So it does like reinforce that the separation between, yeah, the sort of metaphysical world and the physical world.
Yeah, totally.
So.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing is kind of, I remember this bit quite strongly from the first time I read it. Perhaps because I only had the first two volumes, but on paper form. But it's just such a down the rabbit hole moment of not just kind of dragging you down into this other dimension and saying, okay, there's bigger stuff happening over here, there's somebody here, there's Femto, there's Griffith, there's somebody here who's connected to a history that maybe we're going to find out more about. But it also just feels like, oh, this is not just like all these demons are connected to something, or but it's also down this rabbit hole of like, oh, we're gonna go here. We're gonna follow this through, because that's where the story stops, in The Black Swordsman. right? It's like it stops with him repeatedly stabbing the Cobra Man, essentially in the head, and gloating about how he's immortal, and so he probably is not going to die very quickly or at all. He's just going to suffer forever now. And that's where we leave it. But actually, this is the point where it's like we engage with that properly. And maybe that's how Miura was also kind of running at it again and trying to really build up the narrative weight here to actually pull that off, and to do something more here. And it just reminds it weirdly reminded me of, this is a random connection in a way, but it reminded me of the game, Echo Tides of Time, which is the second Echo the Dolphin game. And when I played that when I was a kid, I just bought it. Like I used to buy video games, which is they were just cartridges that were secondhand, because those were the only ones I could afford, that were sold in a glass case in an electronics shop. So you just go in and buy a cartridge for some money that you had, and you wouldn't know really what it was or what was on it. It's not like I read gaming magazines. You just go home and plug it into your console. And Echo Tides of Time is this kind of fantastic, incredible, weird sequel to Echo. But when I first started playing, it's like, oh yeah, this is a dolphin game. Okay, you swim around as a dolphin for a bit, and there's something bad happens, all the other dolphins go away, and you're like, okay. And there's this weird music playing, and you're like, okay, yeah, but I get this. I'm exploring caves underwater, and then I think it's like the third level or something of that game. You just go down under the water, and there's just a H.R. Giger alien just hanging out in the corner of one of the maps, and it just comes out of nowhere. And it's not even in a very like remarkable looking place, just in a random corner, and it grabs you and takes you into a time portal. And then the whole game becomes this kind of bizarre and disturbing trek through some other world. And when I was a kid, that just like completely blew my mind. And I think when I was first reading Berserk, I had a similar feeling when I got to this point of like, oh, the floor just dropped away under me, and something else is happening here, and this is going to go somewhere that's interesting.
I don't want to get completely, I don't want to get pulled to the side, but this is actually very surprising to me. I had a Game Gear was the first video game thing I ever had, and I had or like the first one that was like sort of like my thing here. Anyway, it doesn't matter the details, but and I had it came with Sonic, and then I bought Echo, the Tides of Time, which I
Amazing.
just looked up to see if this was the one that was on Game Gear that I had, and it's the same cover. And I was playing this thing, and I would play, I wasn't very good at it because I was a little kid. And I distinctly remember a day in the summer getting to the part you just described and feeling like wrong, and feeling wrong for I think like a day and a half. Because it was something that like something about the music and the art and this nice dolphin story, or I don't even know if it was nice before, but a dolphin story, and it sort of like unnerving me in a really profound way,
Amazing.
which is hilarious that there's like this is not something I would like write about, because I would think like, oh, it's so specific to something that happened to me. Like that's and yeah, that's
Is
wild.
incredible. I can't believe we didn't know that we shared that experience. Yeah, I had the Mega Drive version, but that is very funny, because I've talked about that game to people before as well and compared it to like other video games, but nobody ever remembers that game. And it's like Sega don't even bother to put it on their multi-game collections anymore. They only, if at best, they put the original Echo the Dolphin. So I feel totally, but yeah, know that moment and the music, you're right, there's this incredible kind of weird cyclical bit of music that plays when you go down into the time portal as this alien tracks you in. And it's,
Yeah, and it's just you're swimming down and down and down, and
yeah.
it's very
It's very
creepy.
cool. Yeah, it's a bit like if you like playing Dark Souls, I remember when I was reviewing, I was reviewing it back when it first came out, and the first time I encountered a came around a corner and found a one of the Black Knights facing the other way, and was just kind of like, oh God, what's this? And then started trying to fight it, and then just being like, oh my God. It's like those moments in games that you don't know are coming where you're just like, oh, something's happening here. But yeah, that's a classic one. Wow. Well, we should do a separate podcast about Echo Tides of Time, I think. Play
Tides of Time Cast.
Tides of Time Cast. We don't have time for a Tides of Time Cast right now. Because
No.
there's something we haven't talked about here.
Yeah, we got to talk about the end of this. I think I did it did come to mind. I did notice when I was reading when they're the demons are talking about hell and this corpse train, that comes
That's
spiraling
what it's
out of the
called now.
abyss. They say that I think one of the horrors of this, and this was something that will come up again and again in Berserk, is that you'll lose your individuality, essentially, that you'll become unremarkable and you'll return to you'll just be one, cell in the great body of demons here. And I can't find the
I
exact
think
thing, but they say that you will enter, you'll return to like the tide of dark souls or something. And just
a
thought,
swell in an ocean of dark souls. And in the copy I
yeah,
have,
there you go.
the dark souls is actually like in bigger font as well, which it's hard not to feel. I mean, I've got I probably need to go through it before we do more episodes. I've got the Dark Souls Design Works books, and they explicitly tell you, like, there's interviews in the back of those where they're talking to the development team, and they're like, how did you come up with the idea for this character? And Hidetaka Miyazaki, the director, is like, oh yeah, I went to you, didn't I? Speaking to the art director, I went to you, didn't I? And I said, make somebody who looks like this guy from Guts, from Berserk. And then they're like, oh, how did you come up with this sword? And they were like, well, we were thinking of something a bit like this sword from Berserk. And they're just like so blatant and flat about, yeah, it was just that we just were like, that looks cool, put that in the game. So yeah, hard not to feel that name drop
It's very,
is very obvious.
but at the same time with this one as well, you have things like that which make you think of we talked about this a lot last episode, but the influence of Berserk. But then you also have the stuff in this is just hilarious. How Mira is just, I loved Hellraiser, I'm gonna put the Hellraiser demons in here. I loved Phantom of the Paradise, I'm going to just use that for Griffith's sort of helmet that he wears. Just these things that are just, you can't be too precious about a Dark Souls, the extremely direct and blatant influence they took from this, when that's what Mira
Oh
was
yeah,
doing a lot
totally.
as well,
Totally. I mean,
right?
he literally redraws Hieronymus Bosch paintings just in ink later on. Yeah, no, he's flat. He's part of a process, which yeah, like I'm definitely not casting shade when I say that
Oh no, I didn't mean to.
they were doing that. I love those interviews because they are actually making game art books tend not to be that frank, but for some reason those Dark Souls design workbooks Dark Souls Design Works books are incredibly good. I really recommend them. And the translated interviews are just so like blunt about influences. They're just like sitting in a room having a conversation with the
Oh,
art
that's
director, which is
fantastic.
yeah, lovely. And that's where like one of their famous quotes comes from about the undead dragon that he said it looked to, Hidetaka Miyazaki talking to the art director, whose name I forget, says, oh, could you make it look a little less disgusting and more like a beast condemned to a long and slow decay into ruin? It's like his notes.
Which, I don't know, maybe, that's the fact that he puts things in those kind of terms might be part of why those games do have the do kind of evoke the things they do.
Yeah. But a few pages before the Dark Souls name check, I actually I, and before we get to the end, I wanted to bring up the little Griffith speech, which is only 4 pages.
The flashback, the pre-demon.
Because it's such an oddly positioned thing that I forgot it existed completely. I thought we didn't until we got to the Golden Age. I didn't think we saw previous Griffith. But we get this scene where Griffith pulls guts out of a, and it's a weird scene as well, because it's difficult to know when it is in the narrative, because Guts looks too young to actually be. I guess it's just a quirk of the drawings, but Griffith is kind of stood in a battlefield, obviously after him and Guts have fought in a in some kind of war, and Griffith gives a little speech about how people disappear in the end, our lives spent never even knowing who they were, but that Griffith wants to know what they're destined for, what is their place in the world, that they're all at a mercy of a great tide, fate, or whatever you wish to call it, which is, like very interestingly counterpointed, and again, like feels like another like moment of like walking down the stairs and missing the next step and going down 4 stairs instead, like into Miura's world now. It's like, well, we've already gone into hell and now we're going into this kind of backstory of Guts. And we're getting Griffith here, and we get this image of Griffith overlaid with the femto helmet. But we're given nothing else, no other connection between how these two characters turn, end up in this position of being adversaries. We just get this speech of about fate and disappearing, and great tides, which, like you say, is kind of then mirrored a few pages later with this idea of the disappearing into hell and being lost forever, and losing your individuality. It's just a it's a really interesting kind of subtle. I mean, maybe it's not that subtle, but it still feels. It's easy for things to feel subtle when the demons from
In
Hellraiser are just
comparison with,
hanging out on the M. Smasher
exactly.
steps at the edge of Dante's hell spiral as the corpse train arrives. It's easy for things to feel subtle in that context.
Yeah, I think subtle, when we refer to things as being like nuanced or subtle in this, it's always going to be a few degrees louder than maybe if you're reading a literary like realist
It's like
novel.
all those subtle touches that Blake put into the intro song, it's that kind of subtlety.
That sort of, I would talk about the subtlety in that song. That
It
song rules.
does.
But I was going to say is I think there's something here too, and it is sort of jarring how much is being thrown at the reader at this point. It's hard for me to tell because like I'd said before, I'd seen the late 90s anime before I'd ever encountered this part of the story. So I'd kind of known about the drastic time shift, and I knew who Griffith was and all of this, but it's hard to think about what this would have been like if you were encountering this for the first time, like if it maybe it would be a bit of overload. Actually, I mean, you did. So I don't
Yeah, I
know
mean, it would echo
if.
tides of time experience, basically.
Yeah, but like with the flashback though as well, like when you have that other layer of,
Well,
I don't know if that.
yeah, like I said, I kind of almost forgot that. Like at the time, it kind of blended into the Golden Age flashback, I guess, because that follows quite soon after this and is so much bigger. It's just so hard to get a grip on what's actually happening there in that Griffith scene. Like there's a lot go that's why I guess I said it's kind of subtle, because in a way it's like impossible to pick up on that connection, those thematic
When
connections
it's
about
all the
the
first time.
individual and power and giving over individuality and tides of fate and tides of hell. Like because of the way it's constructed, I think it's a it would be a big reach to get that first time round unless you're aware of stuff going on, because like you say, you're kind of still spinning from like what is actually going on here? Who are these characters and why are they
Yeah.
all upside down?
Yeah, but it is, I think, a neat way of getting into the core idea here of what individuality means in this world, and or not even in this world. I think it's also a large concern of Mira's as well, is what does it mean to stand out as an individual? What does it mean to be the two named visually distinct characters picking each other up off a field of faceless corpses when you sort of, in the great Dark Souls tide of human history, what do you do and how do you stand out?
Yeah, totally.
Which is a way of saying, I think, that the Count story does preempt things that are going to recur throughout and that very much are part of the main concerns of the Golden Age arc and the backstory of Griffith and Guts, is what is life when you can kind of just be nothing, if you don't make certain decisions. Also, a school of historical thought I disagree with is Griffith's sort of great man of history thought,
Yeah, well, we'll see where that how that
which I
turns
think
out
Mira
for
maybe.
Griffin.
Yeah, I don't think Mira is a big fan of it either. I mean, yeah, this is also he's a young man and who would have been born in what, the early 60s. I think he probably had distinct thoughts about what great men can do to the world and to your country and culture and everything as well.
That You're right, though, that I think to bring up that idea of the pile of bodies, the battlefield of indiscriminate bodies as representing history, I think that's a really neat connection there, and that kind of again pushes at that thing with Berserk, which I think is like, there's no point just being like, look how many dudes got chopped. It seems so beside the point to me of what Muir is doing to look just like focus on the volume of violence, because yeah, it's that's what that scene is, right? It's like these are this is death is indiscriminate here, and history is the accumulation of suffering, which is pretty heady stuff and pretty grim, and yeah, is not the entirety of human existence, but that is that Muir is setting out his stall here, and I think Griffith's kind of purity again, like yeah, in that first appearance, right? We get Griffith, the final image of Griffith, and we get a little bit of commentary from the final image of Griffith, I mean, within those four pages, and we get a little bit of commentary from Guts that says at that time, or we assume Guts anyway, it could be anybody, but at that time he shone before me as something beautiful, noble, and larger than life. And so, yeah, like Griffith is right there representing, even before we know anything that's happening here, is yeah, is like good. The intentions of great men, and the kind of heroism or whatever heroism might be. And yeah, Guts is always going to be kind of counterpointed to that. And I think like to move it on a little bit as well, we get kind of Guts at his most unheroic in the final section of Guardians of Desire, in a sequence that for all the praise we've just kind of lavished on what Muir is kind of reaching for in the past sequence, it feels like he's really kind of misfiring for me, at least
Oh,
in
100%.
terms of how he's trying to, I don't know, like twist the knife or like hammer the point home, but with the most, yeah, with a pretty blunt sequence, which involves Teresia, the Count's daughter, and Guts, who's totally distraught after coming back and witnessing both her father's crimes, his murder of her mother, and then his death. And she says she'd rather be dead. And Guts says, "Kill yourself, go ahead." And then even cans her, or well, there's a knife that she then takes and goes to kill herself, and Puck tries to stop her, and then she falls off, but is caught by Guts's sword. And then Guts throws her back onto the castle and rescues her, but then is still kind of like, she says, "I'll kill you, devil, someday, I swear I'll kill you." And he says, "Fine, I'm ready whenever you are." And then we, but
Yeah.
then he's sad.
But then we see, yeah, he's turned his, and we see him walking away, and then there's a close up of him crying, and Puck once again is like, wow, he contains multitudes. It's to me, this sequence is so unnecessary, and it's like a point was made very well, and in a way that I feel like, reverse funnels the story into sort of thematically and fictionally, and then we do another retread, which is not. I can see the intent is, well, we're about to go and spend a lot of time telling you how this character got to this place, how Guts became this man who presents this hard exterior and is deeply wounded inside. And that's going to bridge us to where we're going. In reality, in effect, I guess it's hammy, and there's some stuff with Guts in these first volumes where he's not, I think, the character that he becomes as Mira spends more time with him, as he tells, if he knew the story of how he got to where he did here, and who knows if he did or didn't, but I feel like he spent a lot of time telling Guts' story from baby to young man, and he gets to know the character, I think, a lot better through that telling, in ways that I don't think, if you had said, Mira, okay, redo the first three volumes, I don't think Guts would sort of behave in this way, or I don't think you'd have this scene, certainly. I think it's like it's very blunt,
Yeah,
and
I think it's exactly that, right? It's like it, I mean, Berserk is blunt and on the nose a lot of the time. But I think
yeah.
I think for me, it's the kind of daughter of the Count who we've already been, has already been used to twist the knife really here, in a few ways, like on the Count himself, and is barely kind of given. We get some scenes with her and Puck, but she is being used by the narrative, I think, here in a way that feels cruel to me and feels also very problematic in terms of her as an image of innocence, as a kind of, and yeah, maybe this is the classical references, right? Like maybe this is also those kind of ideas coming through of like, here we have a young woman in her nightdress as a kind of image of innocence that then ends with, "Oh, I'm going to kill you now because reciprocal violence." But it feels manipulative and feels like you say hammy, and we end on this image of sad Guts, which is almost, it's very disappointing because it's almost comedic in its kind of, I think the
It
page is
is.
on with also kind of flying Puck, and I don't know what the original Japanese is like, but and it's
Yeah.
not exactly the line we're looking for that Puck is.
No, that's Puck is my countryman. He's just saying, "Hey." I think the Supercultured Discord, actually, I was just thinking about this, and it wasn't until you said sad guts that I think there might be a reaction emoji in the Superculture Discord that is a small little picture of the sad guts, which, if that was in the back of my mind, couldn't have helped my interpretation of seeing it blown up here
Yeah,
on the
I mean, it does
page.
look like a meme waiting to happen, doesn't it? It's just so.
He's very sad.
But sad, like I just dropped my toast and it fell jam side down, kind of like, it's
Yeah,
like.
it's sort of like, yeah, like a toddler, yeah, with like the ice cream cone on the sidewalk or something. Just,
Yeah.
why
I
me?
know, and I think also, like, within anime and manga, like, the character who's like, fine. I'm ready whenever you are. And then turn the
Yeah.
page. No, he's sad. It's like, oh, yeah. Like it's almost the page flip comes into it as a bit of like, God. So
Oh, timing.
yeah. But the fascinating thing for me is like, I guess, yeah, we will get to this, is like this is the image of sad guts. But then Miura becomes kind of, it almost feels like he becomes obsessed with explaining why Guts is sad here. Like the Golden Age is now
Yeah.
like, it's not just a flashback, it's a flashback that's going to be bigger than the entire story up until this point. And that's, it's like he gets lost. Like you say, he finds out more things about Guts. And I always kind of wonder if, like, yeah, it's always interesting to know. We talked about this last episode, but like what the original plan was, or if there was a plan, or how this whole thing played out, because it's so unusual to go, we're gonna go into this flashback now, and we're basically not gonna come back out. Like by the time we come back out, this will be a different world. This will not be the same story. They will be impossible to go back to telling this story. That's what it feels like, right? It's like after all of that, there's no way you can just be like, anyway, episode 3, Guts goes to
Yeah,
another
no.
town
Another trembling
where, yeah,
priest.
where a trembling priest is talking to, we've had a duke and a count, so I don't know, like
A
a
lord,
lord,
an earl.
an earl, exactly, who's doing bad things and eating people. Like we just can't get there again. But yeah, for right now, we're kind of, we end at this spot where, I don't know, I wonder if there's anybody who started reading Berserk and was like, got to this point. I mean, it's not, it's the first bit of Golden Age is not part of a volume, but got to this point and was like, oh, I kind of know what this story is now, and just like closed the book,
Well,
never came back to it, right?
that's the worry, is because I think, well, the worry, I'm not worried. I mean, I'm worried in terms of maybe people are like, I don't want to listen to this podcast anymore. It's just the same shit. But I think the concern would be if you recommended this to someone. I think I would have a lot of concerns about recommending Berserk to someone. But one of them would be that if you said, okay, give it a shot, and then this is what, like, I think it's like 650 odd pages in. And, I mean, if you have these fancy bricks that we have, then you have the next part of the story included. I guess you would anyway if it was just the volumes. But if you bought the first two volumes of this on the recommendation, or having heard that it's a really interesting story and so forth, I think you're going to get some cool art, and you're going to see a few hints at something deepening. But I don't think you would have a great, I don't know, I personally wouldn't have much of an interest in continuing on.
Yeah.
It's
Depends on how much you're into people getting chopped with big swords.
that's I do have to say, when you were talking about, it's this isn't just people getting chopped, but I do like, he does draw someone getting chopped pretty
There's
well.
actually,
It's
in this section that we've covered, I wanted to get to it earlier, but it didn't feel appropriate. There's this incredible panel where he chops two or three guys in half with his sword, like just general knight guys. And there's this weird panel where their entire upper bodies like flip round, and their armor looks like a row of soup pots filled with kind of
Yes, I know what you're talking
filled
about.
with kind of entrail soup. And it's the most comedic and kind of unusual choice. I don't know. It's so bizarre and kind of self-satirizing in a strange way that I just can't get enough of it. It's so funny. And the surprised look on their faces as they've been flipped completely
Yeah.
upside down into kind of human soup pots is really something. So
The first fight with the knights in this town is like Mortal Kombat kind of stuff. It's and that's what I mean by it's like it's fun to look at. It's just like goofy. It's setting bottle rockets off inside a shoe or something. Like it's just visually exciting lizard brain, like, oh, just look at this goofy like excess happening
yeah,
here.
it's action manga. It's that. It's just the enjoying the like the pace and the and this is something that I think is really strong in manga actually, and like versus that you don't see necessarily in Western comics in the same way. I think it's a really big distinguishing factor from my perspective. It's like, you do nowadays because of the influence of manga, but I think at the time in the 80s, you did like you compare the kind of action sequences in something like Berserk with the kind of Marvel comics of the time, and yeah, you got dynamic shots, but the kind of extended action sequences that are entirely focused on kind of dynamic compositions of combat with very distinct, like incredibly distinctive stylization is just something, yeah, it's something that feels so strong to me as being a hallmark of manga of the time. And I think Berserk is very much knows its audience in that sense. Like, yeah, no, we actually didn't mention at all, probably because he really doesn't matter to the plot. Miss Lord Zondark, is that his name?
Yeah, my boy,
Who is
or
name checked in those Dark Souls Design Works books, I think.
are you serious? Him explicitly?
Yeah. Yeah, because he
Zondark.
has this really like he has this armor and this big poleaxe, and he kind of like you could kind of imagine fighting him in Dark Souls, right? He's like the big heavy knight. He comes in and he's like the first thing he does is like swing at Guts and impales one of the kind of meaningless dross knights. Like he just kind of he just ro he's like he just rocks up like a heavy in a video game combat sequence, you know? It's kind of it's almost too easy to put him into a game. And just starts smashing around the place until I think Guts even does the classic move of getting his poleaxe kind of stuck in the ground and then chops him. But he gets powered up by the count.
Yeah, he has a second phase.
Exactly.
Like, not to spoil Sekiro, but yeah, he's like the great
Well,
ape. Comes back
the thing
again.
that he always reminds me of is like the Resident Evil 4 Las Plagas when you headshot them and then the big
Yeah, it bursts
tentacle comes
out.
out the head, because that's exactly what happens. Guts chops off half his head and the Count's slug comes out.
Well, for
And then
yeah.
he grows like the more that he is dehumanized, the more that he is that parts of his body are chopped away, the more that he becomes powerful, the more that he grows all of these extreme limbs and yeah, he has to be around. Like he feels like a really strong Resident Evil reference point for me. He's just like pure Resident Evil boss fight. I'm
Yeah, 100%.
sure he's an influence on that.
Like the Resident Evil trademark of introduce the villain's a recognizable human. 3 hours later, this thing is going to be just a goop monster with like just Play-Doh with like some fangs sticking out of it or something.
Yeah, I mean, we've mentioned Resident Evil Village last episode in relation to the fetus monster, but I think the Lady Dimitrescu's transformation into a vast, like, tower-destroying monster is very much in the vein of the Count, right? Like, it's very much in the vein of this, that you have this kind of, yeah, like, elegant character, powerful character who becomes a kind of pile of assorted creature bits in a kind of big fleshy pile.
Which, yeah, and I'd be curious too. Like, this is something I don't know if there's sort of precedent for that as like a convention, in Japanese comics at the time of, the multi sort of the protracted multi-stage, I want to call it a boss fight, but I mean, it is a boss fight, right? It's, the enemy keeps turning into more or less human forms as it's going on. It's also like the JRPG thing too, right? Of you beat the villain at the end of Final Fantasy, and then you beat the villain two more times as it as Sephiroth becomes a angel creature that towers over them. Spoilers
Yeah.
for Final Fantasy VII.
I mean, the thing with Berserk, right, is we've mentioned it before, is that yes, it's a lodestone of influences, but you can get carried away with that. And we obviously,
Attribute
I
everything
think,
to
well, I
it.
think one of the things that we are obviously going to be sorry, victims of is that we are pulling out Western references, or at least I am, like, a lot of the time, right? And then we're also pulling out, like, Japanese influences that we know have drawn from Berserk. But what I feel is, like, the big missing gap here is, like, Japanese influences of the time that are feeding in here, because there's just a sense of, like maybe it's kaiju movies, but, like, Tetsuo, a favorite film of mine, Tetsuo the Iron Man. Have you ever seen this? 1989.
I was just gonna make the shitty joke that I prefer Tetsuo Captain America. No, I haven't seen it, but it finally it's like 45 minutes long or something, and I need to
It's like
stop.
70
It just
minutes.
feels like I've seen it via like
No,
osmosis.
it's incredible, though. It's an absolute.
But I need to sit down and actually watch it. Like it's one of those things where I've just seen so much of it that but I know I need to sit and actually
Yeah,
watch it.
it's one of my favorite films, which just seems bizarre because it is just like a 70-minute horror thing. But it's shot on 16 black and white 16mm, and it has stop motion sequences of bits of metal kind of assembling themselves around a person. And it doesn't really have a plot apart from the fact that a salaryman, Japanese salaryman, is slowly becoming a metal monster. With a huge drill penis, and the whole thing is just this incredible fever dream with just this amazing grainy black and white aesthetic with these kind of wild practical special effects, and this industrial soundtrack, which is just like the most relentless electronic industrial soundtrack. Kind of legendary. And yeah, it's just the whole experience is like being put through a meat grinder. There's a friend of mine, I keep persuading to try and watch it, and he's just like, he keeps trying and then he has to turn it off. It's so intense, but it has this thing of, like, right, body distortion of people who are constantly growing into distorted versions. And it's a 1989 film. And I have no idea if it has any connection to Berserk at all, but it seems like there's something in there, right? Like there's some what that the more it seems more likely to me that they're born of the same
Some
set of
aesthetic
influences,
touchstone that's
the
like.
same moment in Japanese history. Maybe it relates to also to post-nuclear kind of paranoia about distorted bodies. There's certainly an element of that to Tetsuo, because it gestures towards a kind of the metal age, right? This like new age where everything is made of metal. People describe it as cyberpunk sometimes, which is kind of weird because it's in a way it's almost like obsessed with it's like industrial punk. It's not interested in like the information age, it's interested in the metal age.
I see that though as well as like a, yeah, like a kind of my mind was going to sort of like proto cyberpunk as well, like when you're looking at the coming out of the 70s and into the 80s, and a lot of the anxieties, the cultural anxieties about humanity, just sort of like where we were going as
Yeah, but that's not
Eraserhead also was, I thought was in the 80s as well, but that's 1977,
right, yeah.
which I think also might have been, again, a Western touchstone, but I think might have been something that, was kind of in the air as well.
Yeah. Well, certainly Miura does, from what I've read, Miura does reference more Western touchstones, often cinema. But yeah, it's interesting to me. And yeah, it's like, you're right, there is something going on there. But yeah, I think there's going to be a running theme in this podcast that we're maybe there's a few missing
Well,
references. But if you know
I
them,
should.
good listener, if you have
Yes.
hints, tips, references, send them in, please, to our Twitter account.
I was just gonna say we're not too proud to I like, any missing puzzle pieces that we can keep putting on the board here. I'm always fascinated to hear more of that, Can't know everything about
Yeah,
everything.
please at us.
But
Nobody ever says that.
maybe we should only be doing this podcast if we knew everything about everything.
I mean,
Maybe we're
no,
unqualified.
let's not go down there. That's the Griffith route, you know. We are not great men of
That's
history.
I'm happy to be a faceless corpse
We are
on the
Reed Faceless Corpse MacArthur.
That's
Yeah.
right. Yeah, no, at us. Do you think we should wrap it up here?
Yeah.
I do feel like surprisingly like there was more to say. There are things that I wanted to get into with the kind of like the young teenage girl as Sin Eater kind of, but I think we will have plenty of opportunities to revisit
Sadly,
that,
I think you're right that we will.
which is. Yeah, we're gonna, yeah, there are motifs that are going to come up, and yeah, and some of them will become at times unavoidable not to discuss. So I think, yeah, we'll get to some of the stuff that isn't covered in this one.
Yeah, for sure. But we're about to hit the big stuff now. So if you're listening to this, then get ready.
This is, yeah, and I'd say if you're reading along and you're skeptical, I think the next few volumes or so are really well done. I think I know that the entire story arc that's approaching is well done. I can't remember if
I mean,
beat by beat, it's always great.
invariably there will be stuff. I already know right at the beginning of the Golden Age, there's already some stuff that is problematic, to say the least. But yeah, I still think that the Golden Age is a fascinating thing, and that is what we are going to be heading into to next time. So we were saying we're going to be doing up until volume 4, end of volume 4, right? That's the one.
Yeah,
So
that's right.
if you're reading
And
along.
that is the. Oh,
No, go
sorry.
ahead.
Were you going to say the. I was going to say that's also, if they're labeled differently or anything, it's the end of. No, this is too confusing because it's a part within the Golden Age arc that is a smaller arc that's also called Golden Age.
Yeah.
And it has a chapter number that doesn't correlate with the overall chapter
No,
number.
let's just say to the end of volume 4. I think that's the clearest thing. I think the volume,
That'll get you where you're
that'll get you
going.
where you're going, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, so we'll do that, and yeah, like I said at the beginning too, that's not indicative always of the pace we're gonna stick with. It's just looking ahead and saying what makes the most sense. What are kind of the natural stopping points, and to try to to manage 30 years of a series and
Yeah,
kind of make it something that can work for episode by episode
for
discussion.
sure. Yeah, we'll definitely speed up. as we go, but we're laying down the groundwork here. Yeah, and hopefully that's interesting. But yeah, you can, if you have thoughts, please at us at Superculture Rev.
But not if it's gonna be some shit I don't like. Not if you're just gonna be a jerk. I don't want to hear
If you
from
got, I think if you got this far into the second episode of this podcast, we're now heading for 4 hours deep into this thing. I think they're allowed to be at least a little bit of a jerk in
Oh, there are some creepy worms on the internet who
it.
just they'll listen to like they'll play they'll play a game for 150 hours and then be like, this
We're
sucks.
talking about those creeps
I hate
again.
it.
The creepy guy, creepy
Those
little
creeps,
guys.
those little creeps, and they might be beautiful on the outside, but they're creepy on the inside. I'm not judging them by their physical appearance, I'm just saying. No, please do give us feedback. It's helpful to know, but if you're just gonna like comment like sucks, then fuck off, make your own podcast.
There you go.
Sorry, Gareth. I spent too much time getting feedback
Yeah,
online.
clearly. Anyway, but I think that'll do us.
We should, yeah, we should just say, make sure to check out the. Did you just say
I
this?
said at
No, you
Superculture
didn't.
Rev. That's our
Okay, no,
Twitter.
that's perfect then. And check out the other Superculture sites as well. And we'll be back in 2 weeks' time.
Yeah, and shout outs to RTM Trakhanov and for the art, and Blake Hester for the music you're about to hear.